This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن رب ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At our top stories this hour, Pakistan summons a senior U.S. diplomat, lodging a strong protest over America's interference in its internal affairs. Russia says it will not ask the European Union to end sanctions against Moscow, stressing that the country has a sufficient, quote, margin of safety. Plus, a Canadian Indigenous delegation urges Pope Francis to revoke centuries-old papal decrees used to justify the seizure of their land by colonial powers. Thank you for joining us. Pakistani media reports say the government has lodged a formal protest with the U.S. over what it calls threatening remarks by an American official. The media said the government summoned the acting U.S. envoy in Islamabad late yesterday. That came shortly after the Pakistan's top security authority, the National Security Committee, voiced concerns over threatening remarks by a foreign official in a meeting with Pakistan's envoy in the U.S. Reports say an American official has told Pakistan's ambassador that the Asian country could face dire consequences if a parliamentary motion aiming to oust Imran Khan fails. A foreign ministry source says the U.S. envoy was told that such undiplomatic language was unacceptable and amounted to blatant interference in the internal affairs of Pakistan. This as Pakistani Prime Minister has rejected opposition calls for him to resign ahead of a no-confidence vote.
People will never forgive nor forget you, nor will people forget and forgive your handlers. People will always remember that you made a deal on the country. The people here under foreign influence tried to topple a government that had an independent foreign policy.
Imran Khan says a certain foreign power wants to see his ouster because he was pursuing an independent foreign policy. He hasn't openly named the alleged conspiring country. Washington has rejected claims that it is involved in a conspiracy to remove Imran Khan from power. Opposition leaders have been calling on the prime minister to quit for months now. They accuse his government of corruption and mismanagement. The main ally of Imran Khan's government of prime minister quit the ruling coalition this week. The opposition claims to have a majority in the parliament. The no-confidence vote will take place on Sunday. Political commentator Liaghat Ali Khan says the United States wants Imran Khan removed from office as he tilted Pakistan toward China and Russia more than the previous governments.
Prime Minister Khan is making two arguments. The first is that the United States is interfering into the domestic politics of Pakistan, and the United States does not like the independent foreign policy of Prime Minister Khan. I think this claim is valid to a large extent because Imran Khan is trying to take Pakistan towards Russia and China more so than the previous governments, and obviously the United States does not like it. PM Khan is also making a second claim, which is that the opposition parties, they are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. So they're like 9 or 10 political parties, including about 20 members of his own party who have defected. All of them, they are dissatisfied with the domestic policies of Prime Minister Khan. So Prime Minister is making this claim that these 9 and 10 political parties are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. Mm-hmm. And I think this claim is unbelievable, because this paints all political parties who oppose him as traitors to the country. And I don't think the people will accept that claim.
The UN chief has painted a dire picture of life in Afghanistan, warning that people are selling their organs and children to survive.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Guterres said some 95% of Afghans do not have enough to eat, and 9 million are at risk of famine. Speaking in a high-level donors conference, he warned that Afghanistan's economy risks falling into a death spiral without urgent aid. He said wealthy countries cannot ignore the consequences of their decisions on the most vulnerable. The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan last year after the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces. The United Nations is seeking a record $4.4 billion in funding for the war-ravaged country this year, but so far has received less than 13% of the amount. A senior official from Russia's foreign ministry says his country will not ask the European Union to end sanctions against Moscow. Speaking to Russia's RIA Novosti news agency, Nikolai Kobrynets said the country has a sufficient code margin of safety. Kobrynets, who is the head of the EU Cooperation Department at the ministry, said the bloc is not the center of the universe. He noted the EU might realize that a confrontation with Russia is in contrast with its interests. Kobrynets added that anti-Russia bans are negatively affecting the lives of ordinary European people. The EU has imposed packages of harsh sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. The bloc is heavily dependent on Russia's energy sector, and a halt to supplies will cause a major energy crisis. Turning to the latest developments underground in Ukraine, where a Russian military offensive has entered its sixth week. In eastern Ukraine, pro-Russia forces are reporting significant progress. These forces claim they're in control of almost all of the Luhansk and more than half of the Donetsk regions. They controlled about a third of each of the two regions before the Kremlin recognized their independence last month. Moscow has said a full liberation of these territories is now a primary goal, as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has warned that Russia is massing its forces for a big offensive in the eastern region of Donbass. NATO also says it is not seeing a pullback of Russian forces in Ukraine.
According to our intelligence, Russian units are not withdrawing, but repositioning. Russia is trying to regroup, resupply, and reinforce its offensive in the Donbas region. At the same time, Russia maintains pressure on Kiev and other cities.
So we can expect...
Stoltenberg said he expects additional offensive actions by Russian forces in Ukraine. Local officials have confirmed the death of 20 people as a result of Tuesday's rocket strike on the regional administration building in Ukraine's southern city of Mykolaiv. Russian forces have encircled the southern port city of Mariupol. They've announced a local ceasefire in the city for Thursday to allow civilians to be evacuated. Ukraine says it's sending a convoy of buses to evacuate them. And Ukraine says all of the Russian forces occupying the defunct Chernobyl nuclear power plant have withdrawn from the area. The Ukrainian state nuclear company says Russia has formally agreed to hand back to Ukraine the responsibility for protecting Chernobyl. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's preparing to send a mission to the radioactive waste facilities in the next few days. Russian soldiers seized control of Chernobyl soon after the February 24 offensive. However, the plant's Ukrainian staff continued to supervise the concrete encased remains of the reactor that exploded in 1986. Russia says it will stop gas supplies to purchasers from unfriendly states, including all EU members, unless they switch to payments in rubles from April the 1st. In a televised address, the Russian president said he had signed a decree on the issue. Vladimir Putin said foreign buyers must open ruble accounts in Russian banks from which payments will be made. Putin stressed that nobody sells Russia anything for free, and so Moscow is not going to do charity, as he put it. Western governments and companies have rejected Russia's demand as a breach of existing contracts, which are set in euros or dollars. But Moscow says matters have changed given the Western anti-Russia sanctions over the operation in Ukraine. Europe imports 40% of its gas from Russia, and a halt to supplies will plunge it into a full-blown energy crisis. Moving on, the majority of EU countries have opted to grant temporary protection to Ukrainian refugees, as indicated in an EU directive that was implemented over 20 years ago. However, thousands of African and Asian people fleeing from war-torn Ukraine have been left without protection, facing racial discrimination at the border with Poland.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country, and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far, and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. No. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens, is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
Canadian representatives of the Assembly of First Nations have urged Pope Francis to revoke centuries-old papal orders used to justify the colonial power seizure of indigenous land in the Americas.
We call on everybody for the most obvious step and solution to the ongoing destruction from these doctrines of discovery. Here we are today to share with you that we're still alive, well, our language, our culture is strong, and we have, our elders have never given up our teaching, nor we ever, ever doubted our existence. This is what we've been saying. The unmarked graves that you saw is a factual evidence that our people were telling the truth. We're here at this really divine...
The delegates made the demand during a private meeting with the Pope at the Vatican. The so-called Doctrine of Discovery declared territory held by indigenous peoples to be nobody's land. The group says there is a direct connection between the doctrine and the disappearances and deaths of indigenous women in Canada. The delegates also urged the Pope to release all residential school records held by the Catholic Church. Following the meeting, they said they believed Pope Francis would soon apologize for the Church's role in the abuse at residential schools. The stated aim of the schools, run between the 1830s and the 1990s, was to assimilate indigenous children. More than 4,000 children reportedly died either from neglect or abuse in those schools. Israeli forces have stormed Jenin refugee camp and clashed with Palestinians, killing two youths and injuring 15 others. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement says it's mobilizing the Al-Quds brigades in response to the Israeli violence. And Hamas has also said such episodes will end in a stronger response from the Palestinians that will affect the whole occupied territories. Mona Candy reports from Ramallah.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
What happened in Jenin today was a real massacre against the Palestinian people under clear Arab and international inaction and silence. What Israel is doing is not different from the terror organization's crimes.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Nowruz, Painting of Human Morals. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Almighty God very beautifully manifests His power and mercy in spring. The glorious nature is full of hints and messages for mankind. God expects us to feel the issue of life, death, and revival to reach the understanding that it is God who causes the earth to die and grants it new life. He displays His infinite mercy in spring to teach us to be kind toward fellow men. Spring is the symbol of mercy and can be the generosity of Almighty God. That's why verse 50 of chapter Rum reads, "So observe the effects of Allah's mercy, how He revives the earth after its death. Indeed, He is the reviver of the dead and He has power over all things." We humans unceasingly try for a better condition, sometimes for buying home appliances, getting a social position, acquiring more knowledge, or having more pleasure. However, none of these things will grant us eternal joy and calm. The human nature seeks God, and for this reason, it is always in pursuit of real perfection. We humans are after absolute perfection, but often we lose it as we have got accustomed to objects and material world and take worldly goals for ultimate goals. But then we understand that we have not reached perfection and seek a loftier degree of perfection. Thus, this trend continues. In short, it is only being a good servant of God and proximity of God which can fulfill human sense of seeking the ultimate perfection. In this way, human being will become God's vicegerent on earth. If man does not consider himself as a God-forsaken object and discovers his capacities, he will never accept to spend his being for paltry matters. According to religious texts, the ultimate goal of human movement and endeavor is to reach God's proximity. Accordingly, part of verse 110 of chapter Kahf of the Noble Quran reads, "So whoever expects to encounter his Lord, let him act righteously and not associate anyone with the worship of his Lord." As it was said, the proximity of God and faith in God are accepted only with righteous deed. Faith and righteous deed will provide man eternal salvation. God says in verse 7 of chapter Al-Bayyinah, "Indeed, those who have faith and do righteous deeds, it is they who are the best of creatures." As we see, God calls the faithful who do good deeds as the best creatures. Then He says, in the next verse of the same chapter, "The reward near the Lord is the gardens of Eden, with the streams running in them, to remain in them forever. Allah is pleased with them and they are pleased with Him. That is for those who fear the Lord." Islam has considered morality as the best righteous deed which shapes every Muslim's individual and social life. Nowruz is a good period to practice morality and righteous deeds. The more one manifests godly virtues to fellow men, the more he will get God's proximity, and his color will be that of God, as the Quran says in verse 138 of chapter Baqarah of the Quran, "The baptism of Allah, and who baptizes better than Allah, and him do we worship." Dear listeners, an individual wants to be God's true servant. He should be decorated with ethics. Moral merits will cause human being to attain high degrees of God's servitude. In view of this, God introduces Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as the best role model for mankind. And in verse 4 of chapter, Qalam says, "And indeed, you possess a great character." Yes, the Prophet of Islam enjoys a very lofty character, as he had been ordained as the seal of prophets, whose religion will encompass the entire universe to cleanse mankind from ignorance and remove all vestiges of injustice, negligence, and waywardness. He has been selected by God to guide mankind to the best characteristics, which will be achieved through servitude of God. Spring is a good opportunity which inspires us to discover the precious jewel of our nature and seek God and prioritize His pleasure over everything.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
At the start of the aggression on Yemen in March 2015, the Saudis thought that their decisive storm would pass heavy on Ansarullah, especially after the movement inherited an army exhausted by the defeat of Ali Abdullah Saleh and subsequently Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi in front of the Saudi royal will. Swiftly, though, the leadership of Ansarullah proved that Al Saud's unthinkable had been achieved. On the basis of turning the threat into an opportunity, Yemenis now proudly talk about their transformation into a force that manufactures its needs of weapons suitable for the confrontation strategy set by their leadership to manage the battle with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. After 8 years of the coalition of aggression's war on Yemen, the Yemeni armed forces was able to develop its military capabilities and its war plans and strategies. This allowed the Yemeni resistance to move with great flexibility between defensive forms, for example, in the Battle of the West Coast in 2019, and the strategy of defensive fortifications pursued by the movement inside the city of Hodeidah, and offensive forms like the ground raids that the Yemeni armed forces were launching on Saudi army positions in the cities of Najran, Asir, and Jizan. And sometimes even combining both strategies that was not limited to one type of military operation, but included, first, ground operations that targeted the forces loyal to Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi and other factions inside Yemen. Second, air operations that targeted military and economic facilities inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE using ballistic missiles and recently bomber drones. And third, naval operations by targeting coalition ships with locally developed and manufactured surface-to-sea missiles and unmanned boats. It is true that the 8 years war posed a great challenge to Ansarullah, but it also immensely surprised the forces of aggression. What Sana'a experienced was the accumulation of capabilities and expertise following the pressure of the siege, the unending bombardment campaign, and the complete lack of foodstuffs, all of which contributed to crystallizing a productive movement in various sectors, specifically the military production sector. Meanwhile, a quick look at the list of Saudi Arabia's goals from the war on Yemen, one easily sees that none of these goals has been achieved until today. On the contrary, Ansarullah excelled beyond all expectations. Among the Yemeni chains of balanced deterrence that penetrated into the Saudi depth was pounding sensitive Aramco oil facilities and desalination plants in Riyadh and Jeddah, the Yemen cyclone that struck the Emirati depth in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and the breaking the siege operation that targeted Saudi Arabia's economic interests. All of this enabled Ansarullah to shift the military equation to their benefit by air and land and impose a new balancing strategy of deterrence for a war that had begun unequally. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A large development workshop in which Ansarullah was involved with all its formations and units, which enabled it 8 years into the start of the aggression to develop its military capabilities and develop its war plans and strategies, which qualified it to deal with emergency and accelerated changes in the conditions of the fronts and the field, and to move with great flexibility between defensive systems, offensive ones, and even with a combination between both, in a strategy not limited to one type of military operation. All of this reflected a development that made the popular movement as close as possible to a regular army in its administrative and equipment aspect, while maintaining the flow of movement between patterns and changing strategies with great flexibility, which is one of the most prominent characteristics of popular resistance movements that rely on guerrilla warfare. To discuss this with us from Sana'a is Mr. Ibrahim Shami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ibrahim. Now, the Yemeni armed forces excelled on many fronts, on one of which is the ground operations that targeted mercenaries inside Yemen on the border with Saudi Arabia in Najran, Asir, and Jizan, and with air operations as well that targeted military and economic facilities inside Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, and using ballistic missiles and bomber drones, and also with naval operations on three levels here, using with the naval one using surface-to-sea missiles. How do you assess these developing defensive turned into offensive strategies going into the eighth year of the war?
First of all, thank you very much for having me today. To answer this question, Dr. Marwa, let's review together how this war started. The operation started in 22nd of March 2015, And shortly after that, they announced that all targets accomplished by the Saudi-led coalition. Actually, that was by 20th of April 2015. And they started the second operation, which they call it the Restoring Hope. I didn't know which hope they are talking about. But they started this operation when Asiri announced that all targeted has been achieved. What targeted they were talking about? They were talking about destroying all military camps, weapons stores, and the next targets for them was to keep the civilians safe. This is what they announced. And after that, actually, 7 years later, they keep targeting the same targets. There is nothing new for them. That's all in their target banks. On the other hand, our military armed forces, they started, we can say, from actually zero, because they started with traditional weapons, with Kalashnikov, with missiles, that missiles with the distance you are talking about, 40 kilometers at that time. So what they need to do, they need to keep the defense strategy to give us the time, the needed time for the continuous improvement. This is what they worked on, because they have the will, they have the determination, they have the cause. So they work on that for these several years. What's going now these days, the muscles they have, which reach the enemy depths in Jizan, Jeddah, Riyadh, also Dubai, Abu Dhabi, it takes them many years. But what they actually did, they transferred the defense strategy to offensive strategy. So they keep defending the objectives of the enemy to keep the continuous improvement with the times. Now we have muscles, we have Quds the second, we have Burkan the second, we have too many muscles, we have the bomber drones, which we have the boats that we are using in our latest operations. Mm-hmm. We will keep targeting our enemies until we achieve the whole targets.
It's very important what you are mentioning, Mr. Ibrahim, especially that we saw many changes that the Yemeni resistance went through with the deterrence balance that penetrated into the Saudi depth and hit targets in Riyadh, in Jeddah, in Abha, Jizan, Najran. We had the Yemen cyclone that you mentioned that hit Abu Dhabi and Dubai. We also had the breaking the siege operation, which also targeted Saudi Arabian economic facilities, especially like Aramco and the desalination points and institutions. How is Yemen capable of establishing a deterrence equation based on balance of force when their opponents have state-of-the-art weaponry and defensive systems like this?
The focal points in your question is the cause. What's the cause behind this war? What's the cause that the Saudi-led coalition started this war? They don't have a cause. They bring missiles from different countries, from different nationalities to fight on behalf of the Saudi soldiers. They don't have a cause. On the other hand, our forces, they have a cause. They have to resist this. They are they are now stronger than ever because they have a cause. They have to define on the integrity of the Yemeni people. They have to define on the our independence of decision. So we have the cause. When the people they have a cause, they have this power. While the Saudi forces, they don't have a cause to fight. What they did actually, they just keep destroying our facilities, civil infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They are killing people. So what they achieved, really? They don't achieve anything. Just they keep destroying our economy. But for us, as I mentioned before, the offensive strategy is actually a part of the defensive strategy. We are doing this attack to defend ourselves, to defend our independence.
Do you think that these attacks will actually help end the siege, lift the siege, and end the war?
Yes, if we keep, if you review all the last 7 years, you will see we have many target banks, while they don't have anything else to do. They just keep targeting the same targets all the time. Mm-hmm. But the last attack, we don't need to wait for General Sariya to tell us what's going on. We directly know from Saudi channels. They told us what's going on. This is for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely what we are seeing this year from the Yemeni armed resistance is something new and something that the enemy is really surprised with, but something that most definitely is hopeful for the Yemeni people. Hopefully that this will be the last year of war and aggression against the Yemeni people. I want to thank you very much from Sana'a, Mr. Ibrahim Ashami, political commentator, for joining us to talk about the deterrence balance of the Yemeni resistance. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Beirut. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said upon his arrival in Beirut that he consulted continuously with Lebanese officials on bilateral relations and affirmed his country's readiness to build bridges of cooperation with Lebanon in various fields, most notably the economic sector. Now, in a statement upon his arrival in Beirut on Thursday, Amir Abdullahian said that about a month ago, during meeting with Prime Minister Najib Mikati at the Munich Forum, he suggested to him Iran's willingness to contribute to building two power plants in Lebanon with a capacity of 1,000 megawatts for each station. Now, Abdullahian reiterated his country's affirmation of providing the aid that Lebanon needs in various fields, pointing out that he discussed its details with the officials that he had met, especially with Prime Minister Najib Mikati, for providing wheat and other necessary foodstuffs for Lebanon. Iranian Foreign Minister in Beirut in this following report.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived last week in Beirut from the Syrian capital, Damascus, on an official visit to Lebanon, where he stayed for 1 day, during which he met with the President of the Republic, Michel Aoun, the Speaker of Parliament, Nabih Birri, and the Prime Minister, Najib Mikati, and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Abdullah Bouhabib, in addition to meetings with political and party figures, on top of which was Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian reiterated Iran's intention to help Lebanon, recalling the Iranian offer to build two electric power plants, which would provide 2,000 megawatts to the Lebanese electricity grid. According to the statement of the Lebanese presidency, the Iranian minister also presented the outcome of the talks between his country and Saudi Arabia, the ongoing negotiations in Vienna, and the positions of the countries concerned about them, expressing his optimism that these talks will lead to positive results soon. After his meeting with Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib, Abdullahian said that Iran wanted nothing but prosperity and happiness for Lebanon and the Lebanese, declaring that it had presented Lebanese officials with the aim of helping Lebanon solve its crisis with a basket of positive and constructive proposals. In this context, Abdullahian referred to his assertion to Prime Minister Najib Mikati during their meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference last month, that Iran is still ready to move forward to achieve the vital and urban project in Lebanon through the development of two plants to produce electrical energy in the Lebanese territories, each operating with a capacity of 1,000 megawatts. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, received Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his accompanying delegation in the presence of Iranian Ambassador Mohammad Jalal Feiruznia, where they reviewed the latest situation in the region, current developments, and ways to confront political, security, and economic challenges. Expressions of concern are growing in Beirut as the Lebanese begin to lose their internal safety nets at the moment of the intensification of the financial economic crisis. This makes the renewed Iranian offer an urgent necessity for Lebanon as the country's need for support increases at all levels, which raises the question about the ability of Prime Minister Najib Mikati's government to defy Western vetoes, specifically the American and Persian Gulf vetoes, to which previous governments conceded as some of its components were either subjected to American dictates or to comply with Washington's policies in the region. This was reflected in an absolute rejection of any Iranian offer, regardless of its size or usefulness, while insisting on limiting the acceptance of aid from specific Western-approved states, while keeping Lebanon under the tutelage of the Persian Gulf Arab states. In other words, the Lebanese government and Lebanese officials are today facing a test of courage to decide to accept the Iranian offer without coordinating with the West.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese parliament in the loyalty to the resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ibrahim. Now, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian affirmed Iran's readiness to build bridges of cooperation with Lebanon in various fields, especially in economy and trade. This is not the first time that Iran actually extends its helping hand for Lebanon, yet Lebanese officials seem to be taking their time to accept these offers. How do you assess such an approach?
Well, first, thank you for having me in your program. This is a pleasure always.
My pleasure.
Actually, this is very obsessive. This is very puzzling, I mean, for anyone to see that Lebanon, who is suffering all these critical issues, at this very critical juncture of time, we need a lot of things. We have to find any way to get help from anybody. We, for example, at the bloc, at the, our parliamentary bloc, we have said it. Our Secretary General in the party, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has said it. We would welcome any help from any country, from any state, providing that this should not be conditioned with any political terms or whatever. Now we're having Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, has offered quite several times that it's ready to help Lebanon in many different various fields, whether building power plants, just like what you have said, whether with contributing to Lebanon in different issues on the industrial issues, in the other necessities like food and other very important materials. And on the other hand, we see that the Lebanese authorities is turning a deaf ear and a blind eye to all the offers from Iran. Why they are doing this? We all know why. Because the Americans have the veto power. Because our leaders at the country, I'm sorry to say that, those who are officially responsible for the country, wouldn't take a very courageous, I wouldn't put it as courageous a step, I mean, to accept any help from any country, to take, to assume their own responsibilities about the people. If you cannot do it yourself, if you cannot bring from your allies from outside, at least try to find anything as a replacement. Try to give the alternative. The alternative is not there. Everybody knows it's pretty political issues that are meddling their fingers, and the people are paying the price. What we really need seeing, we need seeing the officials in Lebanon taking a step to help their own people, or even if you want to exercise a pressure. If the Americans don't want this help from Iran, okay, let them give us half of the Iranian offer, and we would accept it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Moussaoui, upon meeting with the Lebanese President, Michel Aoun, after the meeting with Foreign Minister Abdullahian, he expressed hope. Our president expressed hope that the rounds of dialogue between Iran and Saudi Arabia will actually resume, given their role in the region and at the international level, so that efforts will reflect positively. This is how our president put it, that it will reflect positively on the region and contribute to strengthening rapprochement between countries. How would Lebanon benefit from a positive Saudi-Iranian relationship here?
Well, what we have our president alluded to is very true, actually, because we know very well that there is a political division, a vertical political division in the country. There are people who follow a certain line, which boils down to the interest of the Americans and their allies in the region. And Saudi Arabia is the number one ally to the Americans in the region. And we know there is another camp here, political camp, which is the, we can talk about it, or we can dub it as the resistance sector and the resistance axis in all of the region. And Iran is the stronghold of all those who believe in the resistance against the occupation and oppression and against the world arrogance represented by the American government. So actually, if there was a rapprochement, just like what you said, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, this is going to reflect positively, this is going to ease the situation, and this is going to make the issues that are very hot colder and colder. People would at least come together, I mean, the officials from this side and that side. Let me put a very simple thing here and very clear. From our side, say, for example, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who's being, and he's highly respected and appreciated, and they all listen to him and accept what he says in our axis of the resistance, whether in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, even Palestine, and beyond that. He has voluntarily, he has, like at the start, expressed our willingness to accept any help that would contribute to alleviate the crisis on the Lebanese. While on the other side, they wouldn't accept the Iranian help, and at the same time, they wouldn't offer any alternative. You remember, we all remember when Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about the few ships that are coming from Iran, and at the same time, we saw that the American representative in Lebanon, American American ambassador Dorothy Shia, she came abruptly out of any sequence. She came to say that we will offer Lebanon the help, and we want to bring and transfer electricity from Jordan, and we will allow them to get even the fuel or gas from Egypt. 8 months have passed, and we didn't see anything materialize in these promises. So they wouldn't allow Iran, or they would put veto, or they would blackmail our leaders not to accept the Iranian help. But at the same time, they wouldn't offer half of it. We challenge them. They dare do it now, and we will just say, good for you. We'll clap hands for them, but they won't do it. This will tell you that they are not interested in helping the people. Definitely. They are only blindly following the American orders and directions.
Which brings me to the last question briefly, Dr. Mousawi, about Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's meeting with Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian, where he explained that Iran had presented Lebanese officials with a basket of positive and constructive proposals with the aim of helping Lebanon. Do you think that Hezbollah can play a role in getting the rest of the political factions on board Iranian proposals to help Lebanon out of this extravagant economic and financial crisis?
Absolutely, that we can help. But let me tell you one simple thing. Things are very clear for everybody. You see, I mean, the Iranian offer is there. It's publicly announced. It's on the air live. It's on official settings as well, with the prime minister, with the president of the republic. So you're talking here about something that all the Lebanese knew about, everyone heard about, and it is presented officially to the officials. They are not taking it. I mean, what Hezbollah can do more than what they... Why the Iranians are doing it? To help the Lebanese, fine. I mean, why don't you make use of it? How can we help Hezbollah? How can it help in bringing more benefits to the Lebanese? Actually, what we really need is a kind of sense of responsibility. If they enjoy the least of responsibility towards their people, they will accept it. If they enjoy the least of independence of decision-making, they will do it. They will accept it. The problem is here. From our side, we have convinced and we have expressed our willingness to talk with our allies to come and help, and they came and helped. They offered officially help. They cannot do it with their allies, and if they can't do it, why they are putting the veto on Iran to offer Lebanon what they offered?
Well, we have to see how things work out in Lebanon, especially when the elections are just at the door.
Hopefully.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Mousawi, member of the Lebanese Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah, for joining us to talk about Iran's, again, offer to help out Lebanon. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast stream. Thank you for being with us. I'll see you next week.
start of popular religious rule. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The 12th of Farvardin, corresponding with April 1st, has been named in Iran as the Islamic Republic Day. This day symbolizes free will and very strong role of people in the Islamic Republic system of government. We have prepared a special program on the issue. Stay tuned, please.